What else she learns at high school is has to do with anti-fascism and labor union activity. On labor union activity, Peoria is the world headquarters of Caterpillar Factory, and there's a sit-down strike or some organizing activities and strikes that she's very sympathetic to. But I think more important to her as a young woman and as a Jew, the specter of the spread of Nazism and anti-Semitism through Europe. Remember, 1933, Hitler comes to power. She's 22, she's 12 years old at that point. So that Hitler's march into Central Europe is occurring right when she's achieving political consciousness, 16 and 17. And although I don't know for sure, I have to assume that in Peoria, Illinois, she was quite aware of what happened. We know in similar cities, which is attacks on Jewish merchants by organized groups of anti-Semites. She knew about Father Coughlin, Father Charles Coughlin, the radio priest. She knew about him when she was 16. An anti-Semitic and immensely popular and powerful man of whom Franklin Roosevelt himself was scared, Father Coughlin, who was a vile anti-Semite. She knew about that. We know from the written record. So she goes off to college already sensitized on political issues. I don't want to exaggerate her feminist consciousness at that point. And it's really at Smith that she learns what it is to be a political animal and someone committed to a whole range of issues: anti-fascism, fights for social justice for African Americans, fights against anti-Semitism, fights against free speech. But also at Smith, where she first becomes more fully aware of women's issues. This is a faculty, Smith, then and now an all-women's college. That is a college where the undergraduates are all women. A college at that point where 63% of the faculty were women.
It's very unusual
very
for
unusual in
the
the
time. Very
absolutely. If you
unusual
look
for
at
the
the
present.
faculties, yes, look at the faculties of major places like Yale, Harvard, and Princeton, then there are really no women, regular members of the faculty. Nor were there many Jews, if any, on any of those faculties. And Smith had, under the inspired leadership of William Allen Nielsen, had brought to the Smith faculty a significant number of Jews, some of them native-born, some of them émigrés from Nazi Germany. So
So she has some models
she had
besides the bee and the ant.
absolutely. She said, has said in interviews, "At Smith, I had no role models." But she was taught, for instance, by Eleanor Gibson, also from Peoria, Illinois, about 10 or 15 years for Dan Sr. Gibson, a very distinguished psychologist who 2 or 3 years ago got an honorary degree from Yale University. She got her PhD earlier from them. She takes a class with Eleanor Gibson. Gibson is married, has children, and is a professional woman. That's a role model. Another role model is Dorothy Douglas, once married, now divorced from Paul Douglas, has 4 children, a very wealthy Jewish woman, very radical, very involved in labor union issues, including on women's issues. And it is in a course with Dorothy Douglas that for Dan, as far as I can determine, first hears the central argument of the feminine mystique. This is on for Dan's birthday, her 20th birthday, 1941, in a lecture. I know this because we have in for Dan's handwriting, again, the importance of documents to a historian, in for Dan's handwriting, her lecture notes from Douglas's course. And there for Dan records what Douglas has to say, which is there is a conspiracy in Nazi Germany by reactionary people to suppress the legitimate aspirations of women, to keep them focused on housekeeping and raising children, and to deny their intellectual activity. Mm-hmm. That, what I've just stated, is a central argument in the Feminine Mystique, written 22 years later. Mm-hmm. So Ferdinand is getting, I don't want to exaggerate it, her education as a feminist at Smith, but is getting a very political education, focused primarily not on women's issues, but on labor union issues.
This is the end of the Depression era.
This is the end of the Depression. The war is coming. There are now more jobs in American
CIO
industry. CIO is organizing, and organizing in a way, as you know, that was much more radical and dramatic than that of the AFL, organizing across race, class, and gender, or race, excuse me, race and gender lines. And the CIO at this point adopting a bold agenda that involved civil rights for African Americans. And so Ferdinand is quite aware of this. In fact, Dorothy Douglas had published, just when Ferdinand arrives at Smith, a book on the child labor, a book that was written very much with the CIO's activities in mind. So she's getting an education at Smith in psychology, which I don't want to underemphasize because it plays such a big role in her whole life, but also in labor union activity, and has come, by the time she's 20, to see labor unions as many others in the Popular Front had seen them, seen labor unions as the hope for the kind of central institution in the society that would advance a progressive a social agenda of equal pay for equal work, of the end of discrimination on against African Americans and women. Mm-hmm. So by the time she leaves Smith in 1942, she's had a really quite extraordinary education, some of it in psychology, some of it in what it's like to run a meeting, what it's like to organize people.
Basic skills
that she's learning. She learned those two at Highlander Folk School, where she goes in the summer between her junior and senior year. Highlander, as you know, in Monteagle, Tennessee, was the central locus in the South for the organizing of the CIO, especially in the more radical CIO unions, the mining and smiths.
Mine, mill, and smelters.
Mm-hmm. This was, it is Highlander Folk School, where Rosa Parks, who shares a birthday with Betty Friedan, later goes to. My point about all of this is that a social movement doesn't come out of thin air. Mm-hmm. A social movement comes out of the consciousness of people as they are educated in a large number of situations, as they learn about traditions of social protests, as they learn critical skills. In those days, how to run a mimeo machine, how to organize a meeting, what Robert's rules of orders were, how to get publicity for a cause you believed in. Those are skills she's learning at Highlander and at Smith College in the 1940s, skills that would be vitally important to her in the founding of the feminist movement in the 60s.
So where does she go? She's getting the background. She's getting
right.
exposure. She's also acting on it.
She's acting on it. And with some uncertainty. I mean, I think these were hard decisions about careers that women had to make, especially now by the time she graduates Smith. The war has broken out. Mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor in the winter just before she graduates college. Given her mother's frustrations, great deal of anxiety and uncertainty about what her career would be. But she goes off, despite that uncertainty, to continue her education in psychology. She had graduated from Smith, Junior Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude. The senior thesis she wrote was published in a shortened version in a leading psychology journal a year after she graduated. Very ambitious woman, but the focus of that ambition isn't yet clear. She goes off to Berkeley 1 year in psychology. It's a very interesting and difficult year for her. It's the year in which her father dies. I think he was in his early 60s under conditions that I think, that is his death, that were very problematic. It caused her great uncertainty about her own future. It's in that year at Berkeley that she continues her activity. For the first time, a romantic involvement with a young man, a physicist named David Bohm, who was working on the atomic bomb, and continuing her political activity, continuing her psychology, and continuing to try to come to terms with what it meant to be the daughter of Harry and Miriam Goldstein. She leaves Berkeley in May, I think it is, of 1943. The war now in full gear, and goes to New York, where she becomes, from 1943 through 1952, a labor union journalist, mm-hmm. with two publications. First, the Federated Press, which was a kind of associated press of the labor movement, right. but on the more radical end, and then after 1946 with the UE News. She's certainly, I think here of Ruth Young.
Yes.
Watching Ruth Young, a woman who was the highest woman official in the UE, I'm sure watching Ruth Young and other women organize meetings, getting up and speaking at meetings that men had historically dominated. And you have to remember the context here. This is the Second World War. Over 10 million men, American men, are off in the European and Pacific theaters fighting the war. And in order to run this enormously successful industrial machine to win the war, something like 6 million women had entered the workforce or had entered the workforce with jobs they never dreamed they could have before, in industry, mm-hmm. In the UE, in Schenectady, in General Electric plants, elsewhere in Westinghouse plants. And that experience, I think, for Friedan, of watching, not millions because she didn't see millions, but watching thousands of women, blacks, Puerto Ricans, working class white women, enter into the productive workforce. And the debates then that ensue in the UE and in the labor movement more generally. I noticed in, I think it was yesterday's New York Times, the death of Sigmund Diamond, a scholar. And the obituary said that between 1941 and 45, he worked for the UAW, the United Automobile Workers. And the obituary said that in 1945, he did a study of what happened at the end of the war as the men came back from the war and the women, in some cases, were forced out of their jobs. That is, there's a lot of interest in the labor movement, especially in the more radical unions of the CIO, especially the UE. There's a lot of interest in this moment of reconversion. What's going to happen to these hundreds of thousands, millions of women who have been doing difficult, skilled, physical labor? Are they going to go back and become housewives? Are they going to, in the case of African-American women, are they going to go back and be domestics, which mm-hmm. is what they were overwhelmingly in the war? So it's in that context of the debates in the left, in the labor union and the left, over the role of women in American society in the 40s that her education, begun at Smith, now intensifies. To make a long story short, in 1952, she leaves the labor movement under conditions that we would probably judge today to have involved sexual discrimination against her. And she becomes married at this point, married to Carl Friedan in 1947. She becomes a freelance writer, writing for women's magazines, articles that mildly challenge the Cold War consensus, and then in 1957 begins to write The Feminine Mystique. I'm not sure in 57 she knows it's going to be a book, but she starts that procedure. And in some ways, the rest is history. That is, the book comes out in 63 and really, as I said earlier, transforms her life and transforms the lives of hundreds of thousands of other women and transforms the history of American women.
Betty Friedan has rejected your version of her past. Why does she do this? Is this, one reviewer, Ruth Milkman, asked if this was self-deception? Is it willful dissembling? What's your take on it?
Well, I have to be careful. I would say that in the past she has rejected my version. She thinks, basically, she's furious at me for writing this book. She thinks I've red-baited her. Red-baiting is an expression used in the McCarthy period to designate someone who is using someone else's affiliation with the old left against them. Mm-hmm. She's certainly, from what I can see, is opposed to the story. She is beginning to talk more, as she has in private, about this past, and I gather there is a memoir that she's working on. So I don't know, in the end, what parts of what I've said she will disagree with. But for me, the most important bottom line is to restore a sense of connectedness between the parts of her life and to insist that the feminine mystique and her feminism have many origins, but important among them are her involvement as a labor union journalist in Popular Front and old left causes in the 1940s. When I talk to about this to varied audiences, to Smith alums, to my students at Smith College, and to historians, what intrigues them most is why her story, that is, I was a trapped suburban housewife, is so different from my story, which is she learned about feminism in the labor movement. And the answer I give to the question of why the stories diverge is severalfold. And I think I'd first have to say that Edmund Morris's biography of Ronald Reagan reminds us of how problematic is the relationship between a biographer and his or her subject. In my case, unlike probably his, I was fortunate to have no access to my subject, no ability to interview her, but which she's declined to do, but to have extraordinary rich written documentation from the period. Why does the story differ? As Friedan is finishing the feminine mystique, she turns to write the acknowledgments. And she says to her secretary, the woman who's typing the drafts, I'm not going to mention you, I'm not going to mention that you were the typist, because your husband, and you have a distinctive name, a name that's not Smith or Jones, your husband was called up before House Un-American Activities Committee. And if I put your name in, that might cause danger for you and for me. And so the first answer I would give to the question of why the stories differ has to do with McCarthyism. Mm-hmm. Let me go back for a moment to David Bohm, her boyfriend in Berkeley. At the time, he was a member of the Communist Party and working on the atomic bomb. In 1949, Richard Nixon interrogates him before the House Un-American Activities Committee to see whether he was guilty of espionage, which he was not guilty of. But for people who lived through that period, the McCarthy period, and especially for someone who was so close to people whose lives were so devastated, for people like that, this is a traumatic situation. So I think the first answer is, in a calculated way, in 1963, she has to give a different narrative of her life in order to protect herself and the women's movement that she might have imagined from people who would have said, as we now know, is often said that the women's movement is just a conspiracy of old
communist plot.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the first reason, and there's no evidence that available that Ferdinand was a member of the Communist Party, but she certainly knew a lot of people who were. So the first reason she has to protect herself and devise a somewhat different story has to do with McCarthyism. And I think she did the right thing. I think if I were writing that book in 1963 and as passionate about women's issues as she was, she had to hide this past. There were other reasons, however. Involved in a marriage where there were fights between Carl and Betty Friedan over breadwinning, the role of the breadwinner, who was the good provider, she really had to prove to him that spending 6 years on this book was worth it and that this book was going to be successful. Mm-hmm. In addition, I think anyone who writes a book like this, which is a kind of dramatic Jeremiad, that tries to awaken people to conditions. Anyone who writes a book like this is going to want to make their audience feel they're just like them. This came out of my personal experience. And to some extent, it did come out of her personal experience. She was a suburban housewife. She was not an ordinary suburban housewife, but she certainly was frustrated. Some of the feminine mystique, that is this idea that the set of ideas that women were would be happy in the housewife or as housewives and mothers, were ideas she had wrestled with significantly in a number of contexts. But certainly to enhance, and I don't know what level of consciousness this goes on, but to enhance the power of the book, it was useful to say, I'm like you. I understand your condition. I'm one of those suburban housewives. There are other reasons. In early drafts of The Feminine Mystique, she talks about therapy that she had, which I would date in 1952 or 3, with an ego psychologist named William Menneker, Dr. William Menneker, who I believe is still alive, a therapy in which, as she talks about it in early drafts of The Feminine Mystique, she discovers in therapy that her authentic self, to use a term that was common at the time, not a term she uses, her authentic self was the psychology brain, the Smith undergraduate who wanted to be a psychologist. And the inauthentic self, not the real self, was the labor union radical. So that those years as a labor union radical, somehow she wasn't fully engaged in those issues. A notion that Judith Hennessy's biography has articulated, and maybe the way Ferdinand deals with what I've revealed. She may well see, yes, I was involved with women's issues, but there was not that moment of click. It didn't really ring a bell with me. I think eventually other issues or other factors play into her holding so tightly to the story. Attacked in the late 60s and early 70s by African-American and a radical lesbian feminist, Ferdinand cast her role and her history in the feminist movement as your average middle-class suburban housewife. I'm from Peoria, she has said again and again. I know what middle American women are like. I was one of them myself. I was a suburban housewife. And I think that's a kind of, that's in the cauldron of incredibly intense, fast-moving changes in the women's movement in the late 1960s, that she positions herself, and the story now has not just personal resonance, but also political resonance in terms of her relationship to the women's movement. That happens very clearly. The extent to which she still believes the story, or the extent to which I've uncovered data that she is no longer aware of. If you ask me, what do I remember in a lecture when I was 20 years old at Yale College? The stories I have of those years, I'm sure, That's now 40 years ago. I'm sure I've told stories that aren't true. Mm-hmm. I can recover some of that, but I'm sure inaccurately. So I don't expect her to be able to remember that lecture Dorothy Douglas gave. I do think it got filed away in that really very powerful brain that she has to be brought up again, reinforced by other articulations of that same idea. So I don't know, you know, historians are very interested these days in memory, not age-related memory, but how memory creates and recreates in complicated ways pasts for us. This is a very big issue, as you know, for instance, in how the Civil War becomes part of memory. So I don't know how much of this is about the tricks, not age-related, but more generally memory plays on us all. So I think there are a lot of different and varied factors that make her story different from mine. My bottom line in the end is, was Betty Friedan aware of women's issues before 1957? And on that, I think my book contains evidence that would convince any skeptic. What that meant to her, how she interpreted it at the time, and now I hope we'll hear from her on that.
I just want to end with one last question, and that has to do with your central project, your idea of dislodging that pat story of Betty Friedan's epiphany in the kitchen. Do you think you've managed it? Do you think it's going to happen? And what are the implications?
Yeah, I think I see this as a series of concentric circles. I've certainly convinced myself and my wife. I think socialist feminists like Ruth Milkman and Ruth Rosen, who wrote each of them two separate wonderful reviews of the book, one in Dissent by Ruth Rosen, the other in Women's Review of Books by Ruth Milkman, I think I've convinced them. I think I'll convince most historians. I think the debate will lie over issues that are very hot on the minds of historians, issues of narrative, counter-narrative, the role of the biographer reconstructing the life. I think someone else will come along with the same data, perhaps with access to interviews, and write the story somewhat differently. I hope that I'll see the teaching of women's history and the trajectory of women's history now complicated by this new evidence. I hope that this will lead to a richer understanding of women's history. We've known for a decade or more that the history of civil rights doesn't begin suddenly, that the return of hundreds of thousands of veterans from World War II is in some ways the seedbed of that movement too, and that churches, not just in Montgomery, Alabama, but in Baton Rouge and Jackson, Mississippi, African Americans in the 50s are involved in trying to fight for civil rights. We've known that there's more continuity to the story in African American history. What I've tried to do is provide more continuity in the story for women's history. I hope I will convince people. It's an important story, a story that I think casts Friedan in new and more interesting light, and that offers a suggestive, I hope, reinterpretation of modern American and modern women's history.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A pleasure.